Right. Tonight, our speaker is Allison. Please give her a warm welcome.
The timer. Why is there a timer going up here? Oh, that's the speaker. That's the recorder. Thank you. Okay. Hi, I'm Allison. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Allison.
And thank you all for coming out. I'm glad to see such a nice turnout here at the speaker meeting at the Golden Group of Santa Maria. My home group is the Freedom Group in Lompoc. And I have always found a great importance of having a home group. You know, it's one of the first things I did was establish a home group when I got sober, and it's like family to me. So anyway, I'm not a representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I say here is my own opinion, my own take on the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the things I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous have been through other people, through our big book, through our literature, through going to meetings and listening. I've also sought outside help and learned different things that way. I'm a firm believer that there is no one way to do this, and that the steps that we have behind us, those, you'll hear people say they're suggestions, and they are suggestions, but they're things that worked for me. And I personally know other people that they've worked for. In fact, there's many of them in this room right here. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. I have a mental obsession of the mind to want to continue to drink alcohol, even though it's injurious to me. I have a physical allergy to it. I don't process alcohol like most people would. And I have a spiritual malady. That's the primary thing, and that's what I didn't understand. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and read the doctor's opinion, and I highly recommend that you read the doctor's opinion, because even though it was written a long time ago, he was spot on, and a lot of the doctors thought he was kind of quack. But that's okay, because he believed in what he observed. And what he observed was that no matter how much knowledge anybody has in their brain, no matter how much knowledge they have, no matter how hard they try and try to practice what we call willpower, that unless you treat the spiritual malady, it's, in his opinion and other people's opinion, it's almost impossible to get sober and stay sober. Now, I had quit drinking many times in my drinking career, but I didn't stopped, you know. I always went back, and my memory was very short about the types of things that happened when I drank, and things that made me feel incomplete, made me feel ashamed, made me feel fearful, made me feel not happy emotions. Now, maybe on the outside I was happy, you know, dancing around and singing and smiling and laughing at dumb jokes and whatever. But it was the emptiness inside. It was the feeling I got when I went home and looked in the mirror. And there are certain instances that I'll never forget in my the time that I was drinking. I clearly remember looking in the mirror once and saying to myself, "What the F happened to you, Allison?" You know, I had so many dreams when I was younger. I had so many things I wanted to do and accomplish, and places I wanted to go, and the kind of person I wanted to be, and I didn't fulfill those while I was drinking. So I'm going to back up, and I'm gonna talk a little bit about what it was like, and then what happened, and what it's like now in my life. I was born in Los Angeles. I was adopted at birth. So I grew up being told, you don't look like your parents, and, you know, and made fun of because I was adopted. You know, I thought it was adopted. I didn't know. Adopted. And so just not feeling like I fit into my family because everybody told me that I didn't look like I fit. I think I was the child to save the marriage, and marriage went south, and we had to move to a small apartment. We moved from a comfortable house in the suburbs with a swimming pool to a two-bedroom, one-bath apartment in pretty rough section of San Fernando Valley. And but as a kid, you know, kids are resilient is all I knew. I mean, I didn't think anything of it, and I still don't think anything of it. I know a lot of it made me the person I am today, and it gave me the appreciation that I have for people who are struggling because my family struggled. And so I'm grateful for that. Just like I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic, but I'll get more to that. And I was in Girl Scouts. That saved my life. My mom was, you know, off dating and then got remarried. And, you know, she had true devotion to her husband, you know. And my sister was 9 years older than me. So, you know, she kind of resented, 16-year-old, kind of resented all of a sudden having to share a bedroom with a 7-year-old. Because she had her own bedroom her whole life. And so there was kind of that little, you know, thing. And she would even say, you know, I helped raise you, you know. And so I was just kind of like the, you know, my mom and stepdad were just waiting for me to grow up. And so I sought friends and things on the, you know, I lived in apartments. So there was a lot of kids, you know, a lot of things to do. But, and I had this, you know, I was really heavily involved in Girl Scouts, and I used to go camping a lot, and that was wonderful. And then I remember some girls kind of brought some wine to one of our campouts, and I remember trying that, and we got in big trouble. Ooh. But it was exciting at the same time. You know, it was kind of like, oh, the case, like, you know, you're not supposed to do it because then you want to do it more. And in high school, you know, I started hanging out with the teenagers in the apartment building and trying different things. I didn't drink a lot of alcohol because that wasn't as available as, like, things you can buy on the street, you know. But if I could get, when I could get a hold of alcohol, I drank it. And so I kind of had this dual life. You know, I kind of was this Girl Scout, you know, volunteering with Brownie Girl Scout troops and camps. And then I was a partier, you know. And it felt weird, but I was drawn to both. And so I continued to do that. And I got to college at 17. And I discovered parties, fraternity parties, to be specific. And all the booze you can drink, and all the guys you can want. It was like, wow, all in one place, you know? And I drank alcoholically from the get-go, and I went from being a, you know, kind of a B-A-B student in high school to almost flunking out my first semester of college because I literally partied all the time. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I was, and if there wasn't a party, then I found the people that were having their little mini party, you know, in wherever. And I managed to keep a job. You know, I needed to pay for. I knew I had to have money to pay for, but my alcohol and my partying. But I wasn't. There was something missing, and. It took me 7 years to get a four-year degree. So I don't know why they call it a four-year degree. It took me seven. Because one semester on, one semester off, you know. But I managed to do it. And I remember all those nights just driving home and being worried I was going to get caught. But, you know, luckily in L.A., it's so big. It's so easy to find back roads and there was always, I always would plan out my route to drive home before I got too wasted, you know. And, you know, to go out partying and have to plan how you're going to get home, you know, because you know you're going to get drunk, you know. It's the insanity of not trying to get drunk, you know. I knew I was going to get drunk. I knew that was my plan. So, And I felt like it was because I lived in Los Angeles, that's why I wasn't happy. So I graduated college and moved to Sun Valley, Idaho, because I wanted to live in the mountains. And I thought, okay, I'll live in the mountains, I'll do the nature thing, I'll, you know, go fishing and camping and skiing and backpacking. And I managed to do some camping. But the other things, they eluded me because I found the bars. I mean, in a ski resort, the bars are just fun, you know? I mean, and it was the 80s, and there was a lot of snow outside, and there was a lot of snow. You could put up your nose too. and of course the drinking. And I remember I was just looking for some kind of. I look now back at it. I was looking for human connectedness. I was looking for a way to get connected with other human beings. And I got connected with people at the bars. We all drank. We had that thing in common. We had a commonality. We had a place to hang out. And we did the, you know, it was like a weird family in a way. But it wasn't, because when you didn't have the money or didn't show, you know, it was all dependent on what they could get from you. You know, the friendships were shallow. And I could look back now and see that, because I had at one time tried to reconnect with people, and they were like, well, we don't want anything to do with you. But in Idaho, I enjoyed living close to the mountains, but I was working two jobs because I needed one job to pay for my living and one job to pay for my partying, basically. That's what it boiled down to. So I didn't do any of those things. I didn't go skiing. I hardly went skiing at all. I skied more when I lived in L.A. I mean, I did. Because I'd make a plan, I'm going to go away for the weekend, and I was in the bars all the time, and I would sleep until noon or so, and then you're not going to go skiing. And I thought, okay, all right, I've lived this place, maybe I need to move to a new place, you know, so I moved to Alaska. And I packed up my car and my cat and drove across Canada and drove to Prince Rupert, British Columbia, and got on a ferry and wound up in Sitka, Alaska. And I thought, okay, I'll be happy here. And the partying won't be so bad, because it won't be a ski resort, and it won't be... Well, when you move to a fishing village in Alaska, there's a lot of drinking going on, you know. And there was a place across from one of the harbors called the P Bar, the Pioneer Bar, and the guys would ring the bell. If they, you know, and that meant they bought a round for the house. So I liked that bar. There was just a lot of drinking, no matter what job I worked at. I remember sipping, I worked at a restaurant. We had a box of wine, you know. We served the good stuff, right? And I would go there, and I would, you know, take a little sip, and I would be drinking wine. And I remember my boss caught me once. And I volunteered at the radio station, and I remember bringing beer, and somebody looked through the little window and saw me take a swig and kind of looked at me, like, disapprovingly. I remember that feeling. I remember the feeling of just... I was like, what the hell? I moved like big time, and I'm still, there's something missing, you know? I thought, this is just not, you know, I was 30 years old, 31 years old, and I was like, all my dreams of, you know, having a career in teaching, having a family, having children, wasn't happening. I was waitressing in a restaurant, which is nothing wrong with waitressing. It was a lot better than, you know, when I washed dishes in Idaho. But, you know, I wasn't using my college degree. I wasn't doing the things that I had planned to do. I had hoped by then I would have kids and do this stuff. And somebody later on says, well, Allison, nobody wants to marry drunk. You know, that was probably the big issue. And they also don't want to get married to somebody that wants to, like, maybe you'll be moving to New Zealand next or something, you know. So I moved around a lot, you know. I wasn't, like, anchored. And then I got my dream job with the National Park Service. I worked at Sitka National Historical Park, and it was just seasonal. But, you know, I was a Parks and Recreation major. It was right up my alley, and I got to teach, you know, about the Tlingit history and do all that kind of stuff. And, but, you know, and we would have our parties, and they were drinking, you know. I couldn't get away from drinking. I just couldn't get away from it. And I didn't know what to do, and I had a boyfriend, and then he got, you know, he did the thing on the side, and I don't know, and we broke up. And then I couldn't afford my apartment anymore because the person that was buying my drinks was no longer with me, basically. So I said, okay, I'll move. I rented a room. And a guy came to work on the, to work on the apartment because I was getting ready to leave, and the landlord had hired him to do some work there, and we kind of hit it off and made a date, and okay, I'll bring a pizza over, and so I went to his house, and I opened up the fridge, and there was like milk and apple juice, and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I should have gone to the liquor store. I'll go down to the liquor store and get some beer. And he goes, oh, I don't drink. And I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in Idaho. I had been told by a counselor that she wouldn't see me until I went to six AA meetings between that time and the next week, because I said, no, it's my boyfriend that drinks too much. I don't have drinking problem. It's my boyfriend has drinking problem. That's why I'm here. And so I had been introduced to AA before, you know, and. And so I saw a big book on his kitchen table. And I was like, wow, a carpenter that doesn't drink? I was like, I'd never met one of them before. And so he 12-stepped me and 13-stepped me in the same night. You know, what can I say? So I thought, well, maybe I'll try sobriety. And I know the date. That was August 22nd, 27th, 1991. And I went to an AA meeting, one a day for 2-3 days, because I wanted to see him, you know. And then it came time for me to get the final look through of my apartment. And they used to have these beers, they were called pony beers. I don't know, it was like the stupidest thing. They were like 9-ounce beers. I'm like, what? You know, that was my way of trying to cut back. I'd buy a 6-pack of 9-ounce beers. And I remember, and then I decided, well, I'm going to finish that 6-pack, you know. So I was 3 days sober at that time, and I had one left. And I drank a little bit of it, and I set it down somewhere in an empty apartment. And I said, you know what, that's going to be my last drink. And then I couldn't find it. And I had sheer panic. You know, here it is. I determined that was my last drink. And I finally found it, like, on the shelf in the closet. But I'll never forget that feeling. I was, like, panicked. I was like, where is it? Where is it? Where is it? Because I didn't want to buy any more. And that was my last drink. And that was August 30th. So I consider my sobriety date August 31st, 1991, because I was celebrating my first 24 hours of sobriety. And that relationship, well, it wasn't a relationship with that guy. It was turned out to be that one night, and that was okay. Because when I walked into the doors finally with the conviction that I did not want to drink again. I didn't go in saying I wasn't going to drink again. I said I didn't want to drink again. You know, to me, to say I wasn't going to drink again, that I couldn't wrap my head around that. I could wrap myself around that I don't want to drink again. And so, and I had the willingness. But the women took me under their wings. Service was very big in my home group. It was called the Rectory Group in Sitka, Alaska. And there was always a greeter at the door. Always a greeter at the door. There were always people volunteering beforehand to set up chairs. And after the meeting, they would wash ashtrays and coffee cups. And I'll never forget how I felt that meeting. when they said, Allison, we'd like you to help wash ashtrays. And I was like, wow, they want me to help. Wow. I mean, there was a significance to being asked to help. You know, and it felt, there was that connection. It felt like home. It felt like, and so I was there in the kitchen, like the meeting after the meeting. And not just the people that were at the sink like me, but just people in there just talking and laughing and finishing up whatever coffee was left and, you know, throwing stuff away. And just, I could feel that this was a group of people that were together for a common cause, for a common purpose. And that is just because we all had the desire to quit drinking. We all had the desire to stop drinking. We all had love. And, you know, I was looking up here, you know, the circle of love. Circle of love. And I felt that. And so I just went in there. I felt that was my job to wash. And then eventually I was promoted to washing coffee cups instead of ashtrays. Because then the other newcomers, they had to wash the ashtrays, you know. But no, but I'm serious. I mean, I felt like, wow, I'm really, you know, like going places now, you know. And I would help stack chairs and, you know, fold up chairs and greet. Oh, my goodness. The first time I got to greet, I felt like a part of the group. And my sponsor, I was so eager. she wasn't ready, you know, for me. I was like, I've done my inventory. But I had a weird thing happen with that, and I'd like to share about that, is I had a sponsor, Carolyn. Well, Caroline, actually. Another sponsor was Carolyn, but Caroline. And I said, I'm ready to do my fifth step. And she said, oh, Allison, I can't be your sponsor anymore. And I was like, well, why? And I swear to God, this is the truth. She said, I'm sleeping with Nick, who was my boyfriend at the time. And I was like, but the first thing that came to my head was, well, I'm just getting ready to dump him anyway. I'm serious. You know, I was like, well, I mean, for some reason, it didn't upset me. And I think it's because I recognized that they were a good match. But she didn't forgive herself. And she didn't forgive herself for a long time. But I found her on Facebook years ago, and she's still married to Nick. And then, unfortunately, this past year, Nick passed away in a bike riding accident. And I felt I felt this connection with them because it was a big growth for me to not react to that news. It was a big growth for me to step back and to see her pain, to see how she felt like she had betrayed me, which she did, right? But she really felt bad about it. And I was able to see that. I was able to be compassionate towards somebody who wronged me. Oh, my goodness. To be compassionate to somebody who wronged me. You know, they say pray for people you're angry at. Pray for, but I was, I don't know. I can only say that was God working in my life. And so she found me another sponsor, and then that one couldn't do it because she had a 2-year-old, and she just never could get a babysitter. And so it's this third woman, Ruth, did my fifth step with me. She was a drug and alcohol counselor, and I didn't like her because she had the grumpy cat look, you know. And I thought she was like this mean, you know. But she turned out to be the best person to do that fifth step with, because she wasn't one of my, you know, one of the 30-something, you know, like I, you know, we're just hanging out. She was somebody who was really, really, really knew what she was doing. And I remember it was a rainy day, but it was always a rainy day in Sitka. It rained 100 inches a year or so. But it was a rainy day, and her husband was in the living room, and he was also in recovery. And we went into the bedroom, and, you know, she had the... And we just kind of, you know, laid stuff out on the bed, and I read her my fourth step, and we discussed it and afterwards. And she didn't judge me. She didn't bat an eye. All these things that I had been hanging on to for forever... She loved me, no matter what, you know. There was something so freeing about that, and I remember I would go to as many meetings as I could. It was a town of 8,000 people, and because we had some recovery places, because the other villages would send their people that needed to get sober to Sitka. We had, I remember 17 meetings a week, and on a good week I could make 14 of them because three of them conflicted with other ones. And that was my new thing. I wasn't jumping the bars anymore. I was jumping the meetings. I immersed myself in AA. I made so many friends, and we would get together and play Pictionary, and we'd pop popcorn, and this is before video, before VCRs, before anything. We would interact and play card games and sing, and it was just wonderful. We'd have dances. We'd have intergroup dances, and we would... and then we were asked by the community center of Cake, Alaska. They wanted to start AA in Cake, Alaska. That was about a village of about 800 people, 800 residents. So somebody who had a fishing boat in the fellowship... He recruited a bunch of us, there was about six or seven of us, and we sailed over to Cake, and we brought literature, and we brought pamphlets, and we brought our experience and showed them how to run an AA meeting, brought them some formats, and they had a potluck for us, and it was really nice. And then we went back to the boat and had our meeting on the boat. They called that rural outreach. I'm sure they still have it. And I just really saw, I really learned about service, you know, service. I learned that to keep this, I have to give it away, you know, and it just fulfills my life to help other people. And to let them know that they're helping me, in my opinion, they're helping me more than I'm helping them. And that they'll have the opportunity to do that someday. Sooner than later. You can be of service. There's so many ways to be of service. You can greet somebody when they walk in the door. You don't have to be the official greeter. You can just turn around in your chair and say, hi, you know, my name's Allison. And what's yours? You know, I did that to a few people when I first got here because it just felt really good to do that, you know. And welcome from Bakersfield. You can give people rides. You can tell them where a meeting is that you like, a meeting that there's this really great meeting, I think you'd love it. You can help them find an Al-Anon meeting for somebody that's in their family. You can take on a position on your steering committee for your group. You can be GSR. I got to be GSR. That was the greatest thing. For my home group, I was a representative for the general service representative, and I got to go to area assemblies, and I got to go to PRASA, which is the Pacific Region of Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly. I got to do that twice. And that was a great experience. In case you guys were wondering, we're in District 52, and we're in Area 93, and Area 93 includes Bakersfield. In fact, I believe they're having an area assembly in Bakersfield this month. Okay. So we can all go see Randy. You know. Well, we can't go. I mean, I can't crash his home group meeting, but, you know, you guys can. In men's deck. So we belong to an area, and then we belong to a region, the Pacific region, which is the 9 western states. And I mention this because that's the unity part. You know, our traditions help with our unity because early on, they noticed that things were getting, you know, people were like wanting to be in charge, and groups were having all these rules, and they were excluding people. And Bill said, you know, this is inclusive. This is an inclusive program, you know. And nobody is in charge. Nobody should be in charge. We should, and so they outline these traditions. And the first one, our common welfare, should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. It's all about the unity, because without the group, then we don't have recovery as individuals. Because I this is my opinion, because I feel that my recovery is contingent on the health of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because one of the things is giving back, is, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So how can I carry the message to alcoholics if there's no Alcoholics Anonymous? Really? How do I do that? I do that because this organization, it is strong, and hopefully it will stay strong. Now, there's some things in the big book that I want to share. And I've touched on some of them, but there's so much in here that I've read things over and over, and then it finally is like, wow, I don't remember reading that, you know. But first of all, in the We Agnostics, you know, for years I didn't read that chapter because I didn't identify as agnostic. But guess what? You don't have to be agnostic to read that chapter. And in fact, I found out that I had a lot of agnostic tendencies, because my conception of God, my conception of a higher power, had let me down a lot in my life. And I questioned that. I'm like, well, you know, where was he? You know, and so this chapter, there's a part on page 52 where it says, well, we had to ask ourselves, why shouldn't we apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view? And I realized that I had a perception problem. When I had one too many drinks, I thought one more couldn't hurt. You know, when I got drunk and said, I'm never going to do that again, the next day I said, oh, that wasn't that bad. I can handle it tonight. My point of view, my perception, my attitudes were everything. That's what either held me back or pushed me forward. Okay, now when I was drinking, I was very pessimistic. I did not, you know, that was the attitude I adopted. I hung out in bars, and we all whined and complained and talked about, we were all trying to outdo each other about how bad our lives were. That's what it seemed to be, right? And pessimism, and oh, my boss is an idiot, and my girlfriend is a bitch, and my, you know, whatever. You know, that's all it was. It's just a bunch of whiny drunks, but I, you know, at least I belonged, you know. So, I mean, you know, I joined right in. Because that was what, you know. So, we were having trouble with personal relationships. Oh my goodness. We couldn't control our emotional natures. You know, when I read this, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's me. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Well, I wasn't living, period. I was existing. We had a feeling of uselessness. How I felt so useful when I was asked to wash coffee cups. That's all it took. I mean, to feel useful, just that little bit gave me that taste to want more, to want to help more. You know, we were full of fear. Oh, gosh. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. When I read this, I was like, wow, that's me. You know, I was having trouble with all that stuff. I still have trouble with some of that stuff, but I have tools now to help me, to nip it in the bud, to say, oh my goodness, I was wrong. I need to right my wrongs. I need to keep my side of the street clean. I need to like take care of my business and not worry about other people's business. I learned that I am powerless over people, places, and things. Yesterday, two people in my day yesterday were drinking. In my opinion, too much because of the way they were acting and they're slurring their speech, and I was uncomfortable with it. I had to leave one friend's house, and then I go home and I get a phone call from another. It was like twice in one day. And I called my sponsor, and she said, that's God working in your life. Mm-hmm. You know? And I had enough sense to know that there was nothing I could say or do to help them. And in fact, I said, for me, I mean, what works for me is to not drink. But I never said what I thought they should do. I just told them about, and the one was laying into me about AA, and they were like, well, I saw two friends that died, and so I know AA doesn't work. Yeah, because their friends had gone to AA, and they decided to continue to drink, and they died. So he's blaming AA. He's blaming, but guess what? A lot of people that come to AA don't make it, because I don't know. I don't know why. I feel like I'm privileged beyond my wildest dreams that I understood this program, that I felt it in my heart. And I think to touch people's hearts with love is... my heart was touched with love when I was asked to wash ashtrays. When I was asked, hey, do you want to come over and have some popcorn and sing some songs with us later? Do you want to help us plan the next dance? Would you like to help decorate? Would you like to bring something to the next potluck? It was like to feel like I belong because I was asked to help. I wasn't thinking about what I could get out of it. One of the my favorite things in the Big Book is in the Working with Others chapter. And I want to talk about this because this is my whole idea of fellowship, you know, of chapter 7, Working with Others. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. That is carrying the message. Okay, carrying the message. It's all about carrying the message. To be available to be a messenger. I'm not talking about preaching. I'm talking about just telling people what about your life and how much you're grateful, how much it's changed. All I can share is what worked for me. All I could share is my experience. I believe that people can get sober in a lot of different ways, but the way that worked for me was Alcoholics Anonymous. There's other ways that have worked for other people, and usually it's a combination. I mean, for me, it was a combination. It was a combination of outside help, a combination of friends supporting me, a combination of my home group. You know, it was a mixture of things, but primarily Alcoholics Anonymous outlined a design for living for me. So intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. That's why we have meetings, because people walk in and we can relate to them. We can relate to... At one time, I went to my first meeting. Everybody here went to their first meeting at one time or another. So people that walk in for their first meeting, I have a pretty good idea how they're feeling. I can relate to them. People that are having problems in their life that used to just hit me like a ton of bricks. I had those similar problems. You know, I can understand where other people can't. And that's, to me, people we're ill. We're not bad people trying to get, we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. This is an illness. It's mostly spiritual in nature, but it's physical, it's mental, it's a threefold. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you. To have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. Wow, to have a host of friends. I had a host of friends in Sitka. You know, I'm fortunate. I got sober in a place where it rains 100 inches a year. So we spent a lot of time indoors. And we learned how to have a good time together without alcohol. I had no idea you can have a good time without alcohol. So life did take on a new meaning for me. I realized I could be useful to other alcoholics, whether they're practicing alcoholics or not practicing alcoholics. I can be useful in some way. So it's an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. I always read this to my sponsees. I tell them, you know, you've got so much to look forward to. To help other people. Oh my goodness. To give back freely what was so freely given to me. It's amazing. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. That's why I'll often hear people say the newcomer is the most important person in the room. It's the bright spot of our lives, because you see somebody walking in the door, and to watch them grow, to watch them become unrecognizable to themselves. But since it's gradual, you know, and we don't take pictures of people when they walk in the room, all we can say is, wow, I remember when you first came in, and look at how far you've come. It is the bright spot of my life, you know. And I guess I'm almost done, right? And then we have stories in the back of the book to help you relate, because no two people drank alike. No people have the same kind of life. But hopefully there's something you can relate to when you talk to other alcoholics. And our stories in the back of the book, you know, help give you some insight. And some of the stories were written a long time ago, but it's amazing. People have the same kind of feelings that I had. From Keys to the Kingdom. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic. I had that awful ache deep in my heart. That nothing before could ever reach it. There was nothing that could reach it. I moved. I got new friends. I got new jobs. I got new boyfriends. Nothing worked. That ache is gone and need never return again. I don't have to drink again. I don't have to have those feelings return again. I don't have to if I don't want them to return. Now there's a sense of belonging, and I talked about the sense of belonging. Will you help us wash ashtrays? You know, something so simple. Of being wanted and needed and loved, because the circle of love. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. And we can have as many keys made as you want. Okay? So anyway, God bless everybody. Thank you.
All right, let's give another hand. Okay, so now I will turn it back over to the secretary.
Actually, isn't that two hands?
Okay, I don't know where the paper went. be able to see it without the camera.
Yeah, my glasses. Let me hear. Okay, I can hear better. All right, I want to thank Glenn for being a service tonight and being our leader, as well as Chris and Tom for the readings. Iris, wherever she's at, for doing chips. And let's give it up one more time for Allison. Man, that was great. Good job. Okay, so she'll be available after the meeting to come up here and thank her for sharing with us tonight. And also, happy birthday to our chip person, people who took chips, and Sarah for her birthday. Let's give it up for Sarah. Okay, and I'd like to ask Joanne to lead us out in a prayer tonight.
And then I got purple. I'm purple tonight, too. Look at this. We have our purple going on.
Oh, yeah, some purple.